So let us begin in a traditional way, three sounds of the bell. And then we have 2 minutes time to bring body and mind here, establish ourselves in the here now. And after 2 minutes, we hear another bell. Good morning, dear friends. So, some last words of wrapping up and rounding off. I've given this time together the topic, be in the world, but not of the world. And so the first reminder, though it was actually unnecessary, was we live in this world, whether we want or not, but most probably we want. We live in this world. And we can distinguish two areas. One is what we call the physical world, nature, the material world. And it has its beauty. It's wonderful. It has its splendor. It is nourishing. And we enjoy the beauty of this physical world. And it has its catastrophes, its destruction, its danger. And concerning us, we endure sickness, aging, and finally death. And there is the society, the interpersonal world, this living together with other beings, especially with human beings. And again, there is this beauty, the joy to be with other people, the love and the care, the support, and also the harm, the destruction, the violence. And it sounds, when I enumerate these things, that these are facts, and they determine how we experience life. We all know life for us is how we experience life. When you sit together and you share what you have gone through, then you most probably begin with a situation, and then I met him or her, and this happened, but then you share how you felt about it. That is what remained in the store, in the remembrance. Experiences which had been difficult are more easily remembered than good ones. That's part of nature. But nevertheless, life is not something as a kind of succession of events, but it is for us an experience. Living means to experience life. That is easy to acknowledge and to say, yes, it's correct. When we talk to each other, we share our experiences. And these experiences are created by us, the way we relate to life. Now, that is something we have to contemplate and look into again and again and again. We do believe we are just experiencing something because of the very fact. And since beginningless times, people, sages, have reminded us this is not quite true. I'm quite sure your ancestors, your spiritual ancestors have said that already. The Buddha has said that. The philosophers have said that. And nowadays, Western psychologists say the same. The experience, our experience with life and in life, is determined by our relationship to life. The way we approach life, the way we see life, the way we kind of judge life. And again, sight and Stoic philosopher, just one sentence. What disturbs men's mind is not events, but their judgments on events. Or another translation, men are disturbed not by things, situations, and so on, but by the principles and notions which they form concerning their things. And I know how difficult it is that really from the depth of our heart to accept and say yes. We are so easily drawn to the conclusion, I have that experience because of you or whatever. I must be angry because you behave that way. We do have deep down the unshaken belief that we are victims. Victims of life. Not just of other people. Even today, to die is a final loss. The final loss in a fight against nature. And it's really true that physicians, these people in white clothes, they often have that in mind, that they fought to have someone survived and they could not, and so they feel overthrown by nature. And in our daily experience, we most probably, at least sometimes, hear us saying, I need to behave because you, or because this, or because that. And so the first step into changing something is a realization and acceptance of that sentence. It's not the fact. It is our way to relate to that fact. It is our way to look at that, to judge it. Epictetus was familiar with Aristoteles. We might not be that way. But Aristoteles was giving a poison to end his life. No, Socrates, sorry. Socrates, not Aristoteles, Socrates. And he was asked by his close disciples who were all weeping and crying, and are you not afraid of death? And Socrates said, wait. I have heard so far two opinions about that. The first is, when you die, you step over what is called the Hades, the river between life and death, and you enter the sphere. Well, that's a Tibetan, but Greek they have something different, you know. In Greek, in the myth of the Greek myth, then everybody else is already there, you know, and they are kind of happy to greet you. They might have expected you, still think, well, this guy is still alive, you know. And Socrates says, what the joy it would be to meet them all again, you know, your friends and your relatives. And you might even then meet people you have never met in your life, because they're just kind of kings, and now they sit with you here and have a cup of tea. Mm-hmm. So it's actually, if I look at this, it's a joy to die. It's a final coming back home. And he said, well, there's a second idea about death, is that it is like an internal sleep without any nightmares. Just being silent, nothing is happening there anymore. You just sleep. And you are sure you don't wake up the next morning and have to go to job, you know. Everything is gone. Is that in happiness? So he said two ideas would be just happiness. Huh? But they are ideas. I haven't met anybody who came back and said it's like this. So the only thing I know is I don't know. So why bother about that? Let's see. And he drank the poison. That is what Epictetus referring to when he said, for instance, death is nothing dreadful, or else Socrates would have thought it so. No. The only dreadful thing about it is men's judgment that it is dreadful. So that is the first contemplation. It's the first realization of all our spiritual ancestors. And we have to be in our daily life again and again remember that, especially when we are lost in blame for whomever, others or ourselves. So, based on that, I said there are two, let's say, starting points or points of departure or two stances, two positions to relate to life. And the first one is the center of our relationship to life is our body. The center for us is whether this body will survive, whether we will live because we are afraid of death. So there is fear, and so there is a defense. A very simple structure and a simple complex, very simple. And so we, most of us, if not to say all, come out of that attitude to life. However spiritual we may be, there is still fear. And especially when you live in areas where it is difficult, the survival mode is present, is very strongly present. There are, extensive teachings, especially in the Buddhist teachings about that we are caught in this survival mode, that we are caught in survive and fear and defense. And they are called the eight worldly concerns. Have you ever heard about them? No. It's something like a traditional aspect of Buddhism taught by every proper Buddhist. And so I just relate that to you, just to make clear that has been taught and we have been warned that we are caught in this kind of thinking. So the first concern is taking delight in having money and material possessions, which is to secure our body. Taking delight in having money and material possessions. That is to secure we are well, you know. We are healthy, we have enough money to buy medicine, we have a house and maybe two, something. Delight, being happy, enjoy. And we yearn for that. Again, as I said, survival, fear, you know, that's a body proper. And with this comes having delighted in sense pleasures. Your body is not only surviving, it's not only there, it is a source of happiness, you know. And some of us are kind of really caught by that. You think about this delight, food from morning till evening, or whatever, you know. And the other side of it is, for the first one, it's most dreadful if you not have enough money and if you don't have enough material possessions. You have a certain idea how much you actually need, even though that is more than anybody else can ever have. And so this kind of an anxiety comes in. Most rich people, and there are some immensely rich people, are afraid. They don't really enjoy their possessions because they're afraid that someone will take it. And the same is with pleasant feelings. We disregard, we discard, we don't like unpleasant feelings, you know. We do whatever is possible to get rid of pain or getting cold, you know. Myself, I'm kind of shivering now. So we are caught in that concerns, you know, pleasant feeling, unpleasant. The first one, have material possessions or being poor, you know. Having enough food is something which is immensely important for people. And now the two social survival modes is praise. We all know that, how wonderful it is to be praised. You know, whatever you do, someone comes up and says, praised. Someone comes up and says, wow, you know, this is really wonderful. I mean, you know, and then our Italian friends do this, you know, polishing the fingernails. When you praise them, they... But if you don't praise them, we can easily feel that we are caught in that when we are not praised. When someone dares to criticize us, he dared to criticize us. Can you imagine? You know? So we are caught in that. Praise and blame. And now the last one, good reputation. You have a position, you know. You're on the front page of the newspapers. And I once heard of someone who was a politician, just a local politician. He would buy all newspapers available in German, you know, and had extra a secretary for that, to cut out all little notes concerning him. And he had big albums, you know, and when you come as a guest or friend, he would drag you into his office and you have to go through all these kind of reputations, you know. And then one day he was not elected anymore. And that is difficult. You know, I've heard of film stars, they started drinking when they had not been anymore on the front page or hide somewhere so that nobody could see them anymore. So good reputation is not just something these people have. We, ourselves, you know, we don't like that someone is putting us off. And that these two things, praise and blame and good reputation and bad reputations, are the survival modes in our society. When we are not seen, when we are pushed aside, it will be difficult. You know, it could well be that we don't get money. And then we are poor and we have starved and people don't want to be with you, with us. So again, I phrase it a little bit different. It's the whole topic of survival, fear, defense mechanisms and anything else. That is the world. That is a certain way to look at the world. And because of that, we have certain experiences. And they are all negative experiences. They are all experiences of heavy, isn't it? So, I've given you another example out of Buddhism. It's a book. It's the oldest scripture, but it's not the official canon. It's something which is not known who has written that, most probably not the Buddha. It's called Dhammapada. Have you ever heard about that? Or some of you? And I just read the first lines. All experience is preceded by mind. That's what I just said. And now I just really put it into your mind, you know. Just please, you know. I could go on citing. But it's the last one. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Now we have two ways to relate to life. Speak or act with a corrupted mind. That's what I just said. Here it means a distorted mind. A mind which is just coming out of the eight worldly concerns, which just looks only for survival, fear, and defense. speak or act with a corrupted mind and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. Indian sources. But that's what I just said. This way of relating to life creates our suffering. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows, like a never departing shadow. And it, some lines down, it says, and you have heard that, quite sure, hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. So that is the whole wisdom of wisdom traditions and spiritual ways. So how can we move out of that relationship to life we are raised with, which seems to be natural to us, which we cannot do otherwise, obviously, to another way of relating? That is, how can we change our mind? It's not just a kind of relating, you know. It's not just kind of something you can do now. You need to... I found this this advice and in the New Testament, and I mentioned that already to you. Do not conform to the pattern of the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. That is our work. Simple, huh? All old stuff, about 2,000 years, 5,000 years, and still not really realized. So we keep on going, huh? We try to do it again. Renew our mind. So it's not just a kind of a something to do. This doing is there to renew our mind. One teaching of Thay was, the book then was given the title Transformation at the Base. So again, it's nothing special about the whole thing. Something needs to be transformed. Deeply, deeply, deeply transformed. So it's not just a matter of acting differently. We cannot. Then you are most probably false in just acting in a different way. You know, you do as if, but deep down we are not. We don't believe. The mind is the same. That's what I said yesterday. So what can we do? We do know it's not an easy task. I think some days ago I said, with all the practice, all spiritual practice is going against the biological roots, it's against the grain of our mind, you know. So we need to be kind to ourselves. We need to be patient, and we need to be sincere. And with sincere, I do mean whatever is offered to us by our spiritual ancestors is meant to bring us into a different mind. It is not meant as a kind of a toy or a kind of a hobby. or something we could do once in a while, and then come back to how the way we do it always. So again, our spiritual ancestors and tie out of a long, long tradition of Asian Buddhism says you have to practice, while he's a bit tough, 24 hours a day. Well, let us give some sleep and have some nice dreams to get relief, even some nightmares, whatever. But there still is, if you have 7 hours sleep, 24 minus 7 minus 7 is at least 17, something like that. It's a long thing. 17 hours a day to practice. And once Thay, just some years ago, he wondered what his disciples do. And it was the beginning of Deer Park, winter retreat. And he had all his monks and nuns sitting there. And he said, okay, come, now we do a list. This and this and this and this. So we are doing this one, we're doing this one, we're walking and eating and sitting and this. And then now there is 1 to 100%. And then in the evening, you please kind of tick off whether you have forgotten the whole thing at 0, you know, and whether you have really been mindful walking from here to there, the way he dreams about us doing, you know, it was 100. And so please hand your checking list in. So after 2 or 3 weeks, he said, well, nobody really did it so far. So I am afraid that the 100% is a bit too much. So he came down to 40, 50. And then when the winter retreat kept on going, he came down to 10. And then finally at the end, he said, well, okay, 1% is good enough. But it could be a lot. It could be a lot for some of us. So take care of your mind. The only energy which determines how we experience life. This energy can be giving us bad experiences. That's, I hope I've made clear again and again. And it can give us delightful experiences. It can even make us happy. So you hope there is a difference between happiness out of a sense pleasure, the so-called cake happiness. The cake happiness, or the ice cream happiness, or the sexual happiness, or what the happiness is. There's a sense pleasure. I just read it. And when Thay talks about happiness, he, not because he's a monk, he talks about something else. He talks about a relationship to life, where all burdened and sorrows and worries and anxieties and suffering is gone. That is what we're heading for. So let us give some concrete measures. I've enumerated in the last days some of them already. I just repeat. And I repeat because we cannot hear it often enough. We easily tend to forget. That's the main characteristic of a human being, to forget. So the first one is the deep understanding that whatever I've mentioned before, that mind who just acts out of defense and survival modes and so on, has as a main energy automatism. All these thoughts and behaviors and actions are infused, built in is us. And we go with them instantaneously, spontaneously. You all have this experience. Something is happening and you impulsively react. And because of this impulsiveness, we act always not skillful. That is a realization or an observation which is the basis for our practice. And the basis for our practice is to be conscious. Seventeen hours a day. You might call that being mindful. I call it being conscious, aware. I know I'm here. I know I'm doing this. I know I whatsoever. And this being conscious is a state of mind. And this state of mind is in the same way as all states of mind and experience in our body. It's a feeling. It's a feeling to be present. Otherwise, it's just a cognition. It's just a word. You feel you are present. When you hear Thay saying, you have to establish yourself in the here and now, he basically says you are present. And that presentness is an experience, it is a feeling. So don't just do certain practices. Bring your awareness to the experience that because of that practices you are present. When you ask to drink your cup of tea, it's not that you now have a better taste of the tea. It's a nice side product of that. It's a kind of a wellness Buddhism. It's fine. But it basically is an experience, it's a practice to be present. And if it's just for a minute, if it's just for a short period of time, in that moment you are present. And because of that being present, you move slowly, slowly your mind out of automatism. That's a point, you know. When you agree that the main cause for suffering, for all this negative relationship to life, is a conditioned mind. It's a mind which is conditioned into certain habits, certain ways to look. Then you agree that to come out of that is to be conscious about that. That's all. Very simple. That's a basis now in this Western world, how we begin. It's not only in spiritual practices, it's in all different kinds of areas where mindfulness is now placed in the forefront. And for a very, very good reason. So the Buddha enumerated practice, a sequence of practices, he called the Eightfold Path. And this being aware is on the seventh. Thay moved it up in his book, Heart of Buddhist Teaching, unto the third. But actually, it's on the first. Because you cannot change your perception of life. You cannot change into right view as long as you're automatically bound in your conditioned mind. There's no freedom. You just look at that things in the same way you did before. So the first step, and if you don't do anything else in your life, no other thing, no prostration, no prayers, nothing at all. If you do that, you're almost already there. Thay used to say, a Buddha is only 100% conscious. That's all. That's all. So let us begin. 1% next day, 2%, well, maybe next month, whatever. Because of that, when we are aware, when we are present, second one, I have to. There comes that there we create in our mind a situation to be with present, to be with what is present in front of me. The definition of sati, of mindfulness, is to know that this one is in front of you. So the term which is then used is, this is it. So this is it is the second step of the first one. I am aware, I am present. If I am not present, this is it is a kind of assumption I have. It is not really what it is. It is something I assume it is. It may be a totally wrong notion. So the next step is to see things as they are. I just said that it's not meant that we are now able to see the absolute. But what I'm saying is we are getting out of our assumptions, of our wrong notions. At least we come closer to see things. It's a great practice. And again, 17 hours. Because out of that, we stop judging. We stop, as I yesterday said, sorting and judging. We see something, and we leave it as such, you know. We don't comment. It's the third practice, not commenting. You see, and commenting is giving remarks, kind of, my goodness, how they look, or something. How can this person be like that? Something like that. And some of us, unconsciously, not really aware of what we do and how we train ourselves, a whole 17 hours commenting. Whatever comes and cross our minds, we give it a remark. Whether a person sits like this or sits like that, or does this or does that, whether they smile or not smile, whether they how they have the hairs and what they have to, whatever. And it's amazing. And it's not our business at all. Really, it's not our business. Let them have blue trousers and yellow pants. So what's the problem? We commend. Is it so? Why? What is it our problem? Why do we do that? It has nothing to do with our survival, nothing at all. It's just kind of being childish with our mind, just kind of play around with that atom bomb. Because that determines how we live. That determines our experience of life. And if you comment 17 hours a day, in the night you have nightmares around that. They all follow you, these people with their hats and socks and whatever. Please don't do that. And it's very easy, provided we are present. We can stay and say, this is it. Then we drop the commenting. Is it so? The third step then is, or the result of that is, we kind of, a word which is very often used, I don't really like, is distancing us, you know? But I don't mean distancing. Distancing?
Non-judgmental?
Non-judgmental was the third one.
Detach.
Okay.
Detach.
No, no, no judgment.
Distance.
Don't judge. Correct. What I do mean is there is a gap between our impulsively reacting and not impulsively reacting. That's what I mean with distancing. Distancing it seems now you're aloof. I don't mean that. You know? I think the other day I said you get the shoe in the door. You don't react impulsively. Because the first steps, you're aware. You just see things as they are. You don't comment. These are important, otherwise you jump. You know, you need to give your mind a certain gap, a certain breeze.
Space,
yeah. You give it a little bit of space. You know? So distancing means to give yourself space, but it has a notion of getting aloof. So I have nothing to do with these things. I don't mean that. Just a little bit of space. And so the next one is you see options. Because you have a little bit of space, your mind is a little bit spacey. Spacious, sorry. Makes a difference. This spacious, if you're not that, you're close, restricted, and you only have one option. The option you normally are conditioned to, you have accustomed yourself to, and so on and so on. You don't have options in your life. So we are now on the next step to give us a little bit of space so that the mind can be a human mind. A human mind is creative. A human mind, the most marvelous system, this mind and this brain, you know. We do have creativity. We do have, provided our mind is not full, it's not restricted, you know. It's like when a painter is kind of stuck somehow, you know. then he steps back some meters, and he stays there and say, well, now what next? So that's what I mean.
Or turn the picture upside down.
Okay. Fine. But it's an option. The very important thing is to know there are options. We don't see them with our worldly mind. You know? So when you have options, you begin to act differently, you know. And because of all that, we give us a bit of space, we see options, you feel that your mind is expanding. It was so far so restricted, you only could see one thing. Now it begins to open up. And even if it's only two options, that it's more than you had before. So now the experiencing comes into opening up, kind of widening the mind, kind of giving it creativity. Correct? And that is a wonderful experience, you know? It might be over the next minute. You come back to the only options you have, because the options which comes in your mind you don't like. But it's an option. It might take then another long time to see it's an option. And the option is not asking you whether you like it or not. It's an option. So that is almost the maximum we do, to get into that kind of a mind which can now see a bigger picture, a bigger image, which can now see other people. So far we are only us, survival. And now we step back and say, well, you know, I could behave differently, you know, and that is good enough. Marianne? No, loud enough.
Being in fear is closing options.
Oh, yeah.
No options.
No. I yesterday already made clear when we're in fear, we move down in our psyche, in our ways to respond to reality. And if we're really down, there are only basic programs, you know. Okay. When we are really afraid, when you are really gripped by fear, the last thing is you turn over and get your feet up. You give up.
Immobilize.
I yesterday mentioned that. Don't be immobilized by fear. You remember that? Your ancestors. I'm so happy that I can cite them.
Although sometimes in a moment of big danger,
yes,
when your life really is threatened, then it's possible to suddenly become very, very mindful and know exactly. And it looks almost automatic that you do the right thing to survive. Yes. So it's also automatic and also very aware, both at the same time.
Yes. Put it this way. A Buddha would always behave like that. So there is in us a wisdom how to behave in a sane way. We even can raise energy we never had before because we are not afraid anymore. You know, we even risk our life, let's say, to help another person. There are incidents where a mother could lift a car to get the child out of danger. Okay? So, if you have these incidents in mind, you can be amazed about the power of the mind, which overthrows any restriction of the body. So, but we need either to be in a kind of a shock situation and get the rare going back to that energy. Or we do it over the years and years and years. You will see the more you practice, the more energy you have. You know? When I have seen Thay since 92, in 94 he almost was flat. Sister Chang Kong was afraid he would not live another year. And then, when he gave a Dharma talk, all the nuns, not all, but some of the nuns just kind of rushed to him and gave him a massage, and, you know, he was kind of pumped up. Because it was a very, very difficult situation in Plum Village. And he didn't know how to handle that. Not in a kind of a mental not knowing, but in a practical not knowing, you know. Buy another hamlet, and they did then afterwards, new hamlet, you know. And then there was a kind of a, having done that, you know. And then 97, there was a first great ordination ceremony, and his old friends from Vietnam would come. And you could see Thay lightening up. And since then, he picked up energy, you know. And in the last year, he was just sitting there, smiling, you know, just full of energy. So the practice is giving us energy, but it's not giving us energy. We don't use up energy out of the not practice. That life we normally lead is dreadful, energy consuming, you know, tiring. We are often tired in the night and we didn't do anything. We are not on somewhere and being heavy workers. We are just tired of our thoughts, our emotions, whatever happened emotionally to us. So just look forward to practice. You see, these practices, I've just enumerated some of them. And I will give you later on a kind of a idea what to do. I like to make you aware that the most important object in this life is our mind. The mind is determining how we experience life. The mind is determining how we behave, as I read from the Dhammapada. The mind gives us energy or consumes energy. So, one of my standard ways to say goodbye to people, I just, whatever, say loud to it or whisper in their ears, take care of your mind. That's all. And we can do so with us these almost simple practices. Being aware of this, stepping back, opening up. It sounds very, very simple. And when you're here, especially Thay, he kind of begs us, please, when you go from this place to that place, be aware, be present, be there. You have heard him? Tired, without being tired. And we all know this is so normal from here to go to there, you know. We just kind of forget that we can put that into a practice. The problem, so to say, with this practice, especially with this practice, is it is too close to normal. Really. It is too close to normal. It is, well, we do that always, but not. And that is a great, 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 almost danger. I use a word. We don't take it as a practice because it's normal.
It's complicated because it's so simple.
Exactly. Yes, it is. And that is really a problem with this practice. You know? Asho Sri Rajneesh Bhagwan once said, everybody wants to be extraordinary. But please believe me, it is so extraordinary to be ordinary. And that is our problem, you know.
Children doesn't want to be extraordinary. Children wants to be like everyone.
Well, that's not just the point I've made. I said this practice I have presented, the practice of what we sometimes call the Plum Village School, is so close to what we are used to do that we don't get the knack. It is a practice. And it's just a kind of a extra something. The other day I said our ancestors said the difference is hair width. That's all. So you can, most of us just learn the practice. And you can even see people kind of slowly and mindfully going from here to there. But they're not present. And that's why I've observed that, especially in the West, I always warn more and more, it is not a behavioral training. You can behave now, you know. You rush to some place, get your car parked, run to the wonderful park, and then you do all the walking meditation. Yeah, it's happening. You know? Or you rush around and get to tea, and then Thai would do it this way. And I'm not blaming anybody, you know. It's too close to normal, the whole thing. You know? And it doesn't help that you're around with other people who seem to do it in mindfulness. You do know it's not true. Because you are now trained into behaving in a certain way. And that is the heritage, so to say, from these old Chinese Buddhism. It's not Thai's invention. The Chinese Buddhism is that kind of a simple, down-to-earth thing. You see, when the first so-called Zen patriarch, Bodhidharma, he came about 400-something from India, from South India to China. And he was known as a big master. So the emperor invited him. He was pleased to invite these great enlightened master. And the Chinese emperor just before had converted to Buddhism, which was rare at that time because Taoism was a main philosophy. So that emperor was kind of proud, you know. He had created monasteries and stupas and all these kind of things. So he invited Bodhidharma. And he asked him, because he has learned now from the scholars, what is a Dharma? And Bodhidharma said, open space, nothing of holy.
Open space?
Oh, nothing holy. Open space, nothing holy. Now, the emperor was a bit taken aback. And he said, well, what kind of merits I have collected building all these monasteries? Bodhidharma looked at him and said, none. Now the emperor gave it a third approach and said, who are you? He said, I don't know. And then he escaped. You know, because if you would have left the palace within a minute, he would be beheaded. But that is our tradition. Not holy at all. Just open space. And I do know people look for something holy around the thing. They go for rituals. They go for something extraordinary. You know, and if you don't present them, you say, well, you know, nothing special about them. Yeah. And so I have seen more people coming, going than coming. What's happening here? Walking, sitting, drinking. And somehow my mind remains the same. So there must be something wrong with that tradition. Is it so? And people come to get rid of some suffering, and they get a little bit of awareness around, and their suffering seems to be alleviated, and they leave. That's good enough. Not more. It's fine with me. So, don't be frustrated. Don't be put down. Don't ever think you can help others. As Marietta yesterday said, what do I do with all these friends I talk in them into their mind and they don't do anything? And I said, don't talk in their minds. Don't be frustrated. And I do tell you, I know what I'm talking about. If you mistake this tradition as something you can change the world, you're mistaken. It is a mind training. And it is something where someone has to go to by themselves. The only thing you can do is to motivate someone to be interested in the Dharma. But if you have a little bit in mind that you are not the one who can alleviate the suffering of another person, you're gone. And you will run into frustration. I tell you, is it so? Yeah. Be careful not to be instructors of the Dharma. You're getting down with your energy. That's not the Dharma for. The Dharma is to be lived. But if we reduce it into a sportive action, we reduce the Dharma and flatten it out. And so many of you are kind of working in sanghas and not others than just instructors. You're instructing people to do certain things, which is fine, I'm not saying that. But be very fine-tuned whether they really get the Dharma or not. Whether they just now do the practice, but you very clearly feel nothing is happening. They are now fine practitioners. That's all. Does it ring with some of you? I tell you. So, what shall we do? Ronnie knows what I'm talking about. Practice yourself. You see, this practice is so wonderful because it's so easy. You are not asked to do 100,000 prostrations and I don't know what, you know. And you're not asked each morning for sit for an hour to do your sadhana with these prayers and that prayers and I don't know what. You're given all day long to practice. Isn't that wonderful? It's so easy. And because of that, people miss. But not us.
They.
Not us. We really got the message. Because even if you're kind of have an idea, an image of being a bodhisattva, alleviating the suffering of all human beings, this kind of a hero, you know, the only way is to be realized, have practiced what you teach. You are present. 17 hours, 1%. It's not much, you know, but anyway. But what I'm saying is, I can assure you, it is a wonderful feeling to be present. Have you ever had that? Yeah? Get to it. Hold on it. Attach to it, you know, get intoxicated by it, you know. Don't drink alcohol, but drink being present. Be addicted. Thay sometimes says he is addicted to breathing. I'm addicted to be present. You know, that is our so-called juice. That's where we live on. Our practice of being present, being aware. The experience of having been able to stop. It's such a great joy. So far you have just dashed through the whole thing and all of a sudden there is little gap. That's good enough. Then you do your old thing. But that is a juice. That is something which could hook you. Don't miss that. And don't say, well, it's not enough. Then you're not practicing. This is it. And only when we are aware of that, I just got through the practice, is it so? When we're aware of that, we recognize it. And that recognition is a wonderful feeling. And we have out of the practice a lot of these wonderful feelings. And they are not wonderful feelings because of the blue sky or the cake. It's a wonderful feeling we have as an experiencing mind. We have the experience that our mind has changed, that our mind has a different relationship to life. And if then someone is putting us down, and we have put in energy for years and years and years, and they just let us drop, it doesn't matter. It does not do anything to my practice, not at all. That is why in the old teaching it says, don't look for results. But I do mean don't look for the results outside. Don't think people around you will change because of you. Then we have a result. Then we do something and we look whether it works. And then we're off. So my last suggestion is stay with your experience, stay with your practice, and stay with the joy. Now you hear Thai, the joy to be alive, but not in the survival mode thinking. Careful, careful with these words. Rejoice in being present. Experience the joy to be present, to be there, to be aware what you do. It's an immensely beautiful experience to have an option you never had before. So far we were so stuck and could not otherwise behave, and all of a sudden the door opens a little bit. It's wonderful, isn't it? And that is a joy to be a human being, because a human being is creative. It's a wonderful instrument we have. It's the most beautiful instrument nature has produced so far. So take care of that. And it's almost outside of us. But still, you know, this little thing, this little gap. We can practice this way and we can practice that way. Okay? Thank you.